Listening Dog Media.
Music, sport, history. Stories from the people of the city. The Manc Made Podcast with Jack Wood.
Hello and welcome to another Manc Made Podcast. Today we get to have a little chat with director Matt Bloom. And don't we bloom in love it? Matt's worked with some incredible people. He's worked with the likes of Henry Winkler, you know, the Fonz. Hey! And he's worked with the director of Moulin Rouge and Romeo and Juliet, Baz Luhrmann, who mentored him through the art of directing. And Matt's got some great advice for not just for up-and-coming directors and actors, but for anyone who wants to get into a creative industry. And it's really a positive chat. Do you know what? Perk me right up. Have a listen. Well, like a flower in spring, I'm joined by Matt Bloom. And that's the most Partridge intro I've ever done on this podcast. How are you?
I'm very good. I worked with Felicity Montague, who played Lynn in Alan Partridge.
Oh, really? What project was that?
Zipsa, and it was with Henry Winkler, who played the Fonz. And it's his childhood recollections about when he had dyslexia. Because back then they didn't really understand it properly, so his teachers used to beat him up, and his father called him a dumb dog, so he decided to turn his painful childhood into a series of books, which were very successful, and then a TV show.
Well, we should and talk about this as well, and it just explained before this, that you're a director, of course, and you directed these episodes with Henry and Lynn from Alan Partridge. I know she has a real name, but for me, that's who she will forever be. How did you get involved in that project? Because that's like a big, that's a really big cast, and it was like a CBBC production, correct?
Yeah. I really pitched hard for it because I knew it was going to be something very special. I knew that they wanted a really premium set of adult stars in it. Javon Prince and Neil Fitzmaurice from Phoenix Knights, and of course Henry and Felicity. So it's interesting. Directors now go for as many auditions as actors do. So you go for multiple meetings and you have to pitch, you have to do your TED talk if you want to get a job like that.
What does that involve? So let's say for that process, for that show, what did you go in? What was your pitch like? How is that different from an actor's audition?
Well, it's weird. In just a few years ago, you just meet a producer for coffee, and if they got on with you, then they'd give you the job. But now the competition is so high, and also the budgets of everything are so high, everything is sort of high stake, that you really have to give your proper TED talk. You need visual presentations, and you need to have really broken down the script and say exactly what your vision is and why you should be the chosen director for it.
So in terms of like the for this one with the Henry Winkler's books, did you read all the books beforehand to make sure that you understood it and how you wanted to bring it to the screen and stuff like that?
So I read all of his books and digested them, and I knew not only was he going to star in it, but also that his books were very, very personal to him, because they were about his very painful childhood, and he felt very passionately about dyslexia, and also how difficult it was for him to just to write the books, because he's severely dyslexic. So the achievement of writing these books were a massive thing. So when I met him, I knew that, you know, I had to win him over, that this idiot from Manchester was going to take care of his childhood.
So yeah, that's incredible to get the chance to do that, to sort of be correct, put his vision to the screen in a way. And it has to be, is that a director's job to sort of filter the vision and make sure it comes through as it should be? And you get to put your own twists on that, and you have to sort of, I guess you have to go through him as well as it goes through you. There's decisions that you must have made that he must have gone, are you sure? And decisions that he wanted that you must have gone, maybe not. Is it hard to balance that as a director?
Your job as a director mainly is a storyteller. So you're bringing a story to life and bring it on screen. And if you can tell the difference between a David Lynch film and a Michael Bay film, that's how a director can bring their different vision and feeling and tastes to a story. With Henry, he wants things of very, very high quality. You know, he made everyone raise his game. But once he trusts you, once you're in that sort of circle, then he's very, very playful and very, very amenable to people changing the stories and the ideas. He was in his 60s when he did that, but he had the energy and enthusiasm of a 19-year-old Jewish New York stand-up comedian, and sort of demanded that energy of everyone else. Which was interesting that his energy and his techniques were very, very different from Felicity Montague, who played Lynn in Alan Partridge. Mm. She's very method and she likes motivation behind everything, whereas Henry likes to just improvise because scripts don't mean that much to him because he's dyslexic and he likes to just play. So these two very different techniques came together and created something that was magic. They both fell in love with one another, even though their techniques were polar opposite.
Is that difficult for you to direct in a way you have to use two different methods? Do you have to use a different method for each actor, would you say?
Yeah, sort of and you have to figure out very fast what their method is because they don't tell you. but in the case of those two actors, they're both brilliant. They both liked one another. They just needed different things. So your brain is working overtime. You know, if an actor needs motivation for anything, why am I picking up this mug? Why am I coming through this door? You can answer all of those questions. You should have all of those answers ready in your mind. And then if an actor says, I like to improvise, well, rather than saying, you've got to stand there because I planned this and we've lit for just that one spot, then you tell the director of photography, the lighting cinematographer, you know, lights for that area. And you tell the camera person, stay loose with the camera. So wherever this person goes, we will follow them. And that's what we did. That's one of the joys of directing. You never know what kind of actors you're going to get.
See, that sounds great on paper, but actually those people that seem to just do what they want sounds a nightmare really to film. It sounds like extra steps. I want someone that does what they say and you know what you're going to do. But I guess that's the joy of it. You're getting lots of different things. But I feel like, Matt, we should go back in time a little bit and just ask, how did you get into directing? Because as opposed to acting, there seems to be like a methodology. You can go through like different productions. You can go through like a school and stuff like that. But directing doesn't seem to be like, you don't imagine as a kid you go, oh, I want to be the one that makes this film rather than I want to be the one that stars that film. So how did it begin for you, Matt?
I've always loved movies. I've always had a passion for movies. And I guess it's reading those making of books and watching the making of behind the scenes videos. And that's the kind of job that I want. I don't want to be in front of the camera. I don't want to do any other job. That's that kind of storyteller who's in charge of everything sounds fun. And it's just watching Spielberg and behind the scenes the shorts that you'd get on DVDs and VHSs. And growing up, South Manchester didn't have a lot of money, didn't have access to a camcorder. So a camcorder sort of took on this mythical thing for me in my life. You know, now everybody has a camera in their phone. And, you know, it's something that people just take for granted. But when I was a kid, we just didn't have access to that. So when I eventually managed to buy one with the help of a charity, it sort of had huge importance to me. And it was getting that camcorder that let me get to film school, which I went to 3 years to the Welsh Film School.
What age did you go to the Welsh Film School, Matt?
I was 18. Very, very young, very green. And when I left there, I thought it would be like any other degree, like medicine or law, that when you leave, you'll get headhunted by, you know, the BBC or Warner Brothers or whatever, and then just unemployment and desperation and poverty and rejection. And the joke was that I thought that I had so many rejection letters that I thought I was going to plaster my bathroom wall with all the rejection letters of the people that bothered replying.
Well, it's inspiring now, if you did that in a way, but heavily depressing then. But so what I want to understand though is when you had this camcorder, and did you immediately start writing your own things and creating your own stuff? Like, how did you go from just a guy that had a camcorder to getting into this film school? Because it's not just as simple as going, I've got a camera, can I come in? I imagine you had to create stuff to prove that you were ready for this sort of school.
You know, I haven't changed my technique. It was just messing around with my friends and telling stories. And I don't think I do anything different now. And it was just telling silly little stories. In fact, the one that got me into the film school was a story with a rubber chicken, the adventures of a rubber chicken around London. Because it's hard to get hold of actors. It's much easier to work with a rubber chicken. So that was the one that got me into film school.
So is that advice you give to someone? Who's
buy a rubber chicken. It's really important.
Yeah. buyer of a ticket. But the thing is, that's the point. You mentioned about smartphones. Like, if you want to direct, you should just go. It doesn't matter about what you're filming it on. You've got a phone. Go out and film it. Create something. Is that the best technique to learn?
That is the best piece of advice, because so many people think that you need expensive equipment, and that if you fall into that trap, then you'll never get anything made. If you think that I need professional actors, or I need certain lighting or a camera, by the time you've afforded that, you haven't built up your body of work. And I'm a passionate believer in Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours. And he's the author that came up with the theory that to become an expert, or at least very proficient at something, you need 10,000 hours of practice. And it's not an exact number. And of course, you know, there are critics of the theory, but I think it really gives you a roadmap, because so many people think of our profession as something that you're just waiting for inspiration, or you're waiting for your muse to come, or waiting to be discovered. And that's Simon Cowell's fault. He's sort of made a generation of people think, you know, any minute now I'll get discovered. And in fact, what you need to do is earn your 10,000 hours. You need to get out there and make your films. Keep on making films. And it doesn't matter how cheap or crappy they are. In fact, it's good if they're crappy. It's good if you fail. It's important to fail. But just keep on making films. And my main advice, in fact, is to treat it as though you were a trainee professional athlete or a trainee surgeon. So rather than thinking of it as, it is an art form, but rather than think of it waiting for the muse to hit, you've got to be hitting the track at 4 a.m. every day, metaphorically, or 7 years of studying the thickest medical textbooks. How can you earn your 10,000 hours?
That's amazing advice. And I've wanted to ask, because I was thinking about this when you're talking about just going out and making stuff. As a director, what do you think of like kids using like TikTok and stuff like that now? Do you think that's sort of a step in that direction? Because you are creating your own content, but it's sort of a trend in a way.
I love TikTok. It's so addictive. And I think some people are using it so creatively. And what's fascinating now is you watch some TikTok and it's way more creative than our Hollywood film. There's ideas in there, there's a freedom in there that you don't find in traditional TV. And I think we can all be inspired by that. Although they are getting used to making things that only last a minute, to the attention spans of our audiences. I think it would be great to use that kind of freedom and energy, but in longer stories.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I think it's a good jumping off platform to get people into creating things that might not have normally done that. And I think, in a way, lockdowns force people to do that, because if you've been sitting around twiddling your thumbs for a while, it's quite fun to try and make something new. So I guess there's going to be a lot more directors out there very soon. But I wanted to touch on a little bit. You mentioned you had the help of a charity in Manchester to get you your first camera. Can you remember what that charity was?
It's the Prince's Trust. So Prince Charles's charity, whatever you think of the royalty, his charity is fantastic, because he has the charity that if you show promise but you don't have any money, he'll help you. And I think that's a great scheme, because they say if you do a job that you hate and raise a proportion of money for your camera or whatever it is, we'll pay the rest. And they did that with me, because I can never have afforded a camera, certainly at 17. So I'm forever grateful to them, and they helped give me advice and a free lawyer and things like that, things that you don't think you need, but in fact you do need.
And do you think there is enough support for like the arts and stuff like that in Manchester for people who want to kind of get it?
No, and I think whilst we're talking about issues like Black Lives Matter, a lot of representation has happened in front of the camera. You can argue not enough, but great strides have been made. And yet when I look around my sets, no matter what country or city I work in, there'll be women doing, you can't hear this on a podcast, but I'm doing the inverted commas things that everyone hates, but women doing women's jobs. And only 15% of women are directors. And openly gay people doing openly gay jobs, again, inverted commas. And one black face. Now, that's not, you don't have to be politically correct to see that that's not representative of the country, and something has to change. I think there's still those class barriers as well. And if I have a message for anyone, it's I've seen good directors, and there's something that does make a good director. It's something to do with passion and energy and good storytelling and leadership and a bit of mania. It's absolutely nothing to do with your race, your class, your gender, your sexuality. And I think we need to enforce that, especially from people from Manchester, because you seems like this impenetrable wall, the TV and film industry, when you're from Manchester. And it didn't.
No, there is ways. So how did you, because you mentioned that you left the Welsh International Film School, and then you felt like they're unemployed. Like, how did you then go from having that to then getting your first directing job? Like, what's the technique and what advice once you've got that?
My folks were very supportive. They didn't kick me out, and I made a lot of sacrifices, and I got poorer and poorer and poorer and more desperate. And, I kept on making these short films and posting them out into the world, and I thought it was just peeing in the wind. Yeah. And then one of them got seen by 20th Century Fox, and they passed it to Baz Luhrmann, the director of Moulin Rouge and Romeo and Juliet. And he changed my life, basically. He just turned 40 and he wanted to give something back, and I think 20th Century Fox wanted some publicity. So he said, well, I'll mentor you.
Oh, wow.
And so the idea was he was just going to take a photo with me, and he was just going to give me some advice if I made some. Then he changed his mind. He said, actually, no, that's not going to do it. You know, it's not going to help you at all. Why don't we make a film together? We'll make a short film. I'll come to Manchester, wherever you live. Where is it, Manchester? We'll make a short film, and I'll put it on before the world premiere of my movie, which is in 3 days' time.
That must have blown your mind, also been terrifying, surely.
I had my first and only panic attack. The room started to swirl, and the adverts on the wall, because I was in London Underground, started to sort of sway and move. But I picked myself up, and it was so strange. I was making this short film with my mates, like I normally did, on my crappy camcorder, and running around the G-Mex. After a couple of hours of us just filming on our own, he turns up in a limo. The world's press turn up, and we call random people to. We got Brenda Blessing in it. We got Baby Spice in it. We were just calling random people. Do you want to be in a film? Baz Luhrmann's going to be there, of course. We drove down, handed it to London, handed it to the projectionist, and next thing we were meeting, it was Moulin Rouge, so we were meeting Nicole Kidman and Prince Charles.
And that was in the space really of a couple of weeks?
I mean, nuts, absolutely flipping nuts. But it sort of upset me, because all those doors that were impenetrably shut to me were flung open, and my work wasn't any different. 2 days before, 2 days after, but it did show that that's the way that the industry works, you know.
It's who you know, sadly, though.
It is who you know. I think I made that happen by innocently sending films out again and again and again, not giving up. So yeah. I give myself some credit for that. But suddenly I had an agent and an advertising deal, and that set me on the course to making TV.
Wow. So which short film was it? Because I watched a couple of your short films last night. I watched Small Things and I watched Endless. And you love a twist, man. You wrote those ones as well, didn't you? Which is brilliant.
Yeah.
Is that something you have to do, you reckon, to get into director? You've got to be willing to sort of do all aspects to make sure that you can, well, do them, I guess, and understand them.
It's a piece of advice that Stanley Kubrick gave, which is you shouldn't be able to lead people without having done a bit of that job yourself. So you should know a bit of acting, even if you don't want to be an actor. You should hold the boom that has the microphone on. You should do a bit of camera work. You should do all of those jobs. So my advice for any filmmaker is nothing is beneath you. You should do a bit of makeup and hair and sound work if you want to be able to ask things of people eventually.
How are you at makeup and hair?
As you can see, pretty during lockdown hair, pretty daffy.
Yeah. Everyone's got the same, mate. I'm just waiting. I am waiting for my haircut. I booked in. I'll get it on Saturday, and I'm waiting for it. But anyway, this is not about me, man. Yeah, I watched both your films. Short, Small Things made me really laugh because it's the best reference to Boris I've ever seen. Endless, I did. I had to watch it twice because I was like, at what point? Because honestly, I if you listen to this, and we can try and if Callum, the producer's listening right now, put a link to Endless in the bio of the podcast, please, because there is. You think you understand it in the first 30 seconds, and then it changes, and then it changes again, and it constantly changes throughout the like 7 or so minutes that it's on, and it's genius and it's incredibly well shot, and like it really sucks you in, and you've won awards for both of those short films as well. Was this before or after the big Moulin Rouge escapades?
It was after. Thank you, Jack. I mean, I'm really glad you enjoyed it.
Because then me
just messing around on a weekend, and because when you make TV, you've got some control. When you make adverts, you've got no control at all, but a lot of money. And when you make shorts, you've got all the control in the world and creativity, but you've got no money because it's coming out of your own pocket. So yeah. It's me messing around and trying things without when the stakes are very low and there's no producers telling me that I've done bad. I'm really glad that they did so well.
Both won awards, didn't they, which was great. And do you think as a director do you need to have all of those different elements? So you mentioned you have to do commercials, and I know you've done some for like the co-op, etc., and you do TV as well, which is obviously still your passion, but then if you want to be well-rounded and stuff like that, do you have to do your own projects to make sure that you're reaching out on that side, or can you just get stuck in commercial in a way?
My passion is storytelling, so I really don't mind what medium it is. And I, like I said, you do commercials, you're spending 2 days being a perfectionist, moving a product around like millimeter by millimeter until it's perfectly lit. And there's something to be said for that. And then when you're doing short films, there's a huge freedom that you're just flying around with your camera and you've got no responsibilities in a tiny crew. And then when you're doing TV, it's sort of in the middle. Like the last thing I did was quite an expensive European production in Paris. So it was it's called Find Me in Paris. It's a science fiction show with Disney's money and German money, about a ballerina that travels in time from 1905 to this year and has to hide her secret.
Oh wow! Is that a film or a series or?
It's a series, but I really love working with the French because they're very, very passionate about their directors, and they consider directors to be very important as part of their culture. So I really love that.
So is there anything, like, cause you've done these short films, you've done this working with Disney, is there a project like a novel or a book or anything that you'd love one day to direct and sink your teeth into that you really want to get involved in more?
I won't be able to do this because it's way over my my station and somebody else is already doing it, but Neil Gaiman's The Sandman graphic novel.
His stuff's amazing. I just finished reading, what was the one that was on Amazon Prime recently? Neil Gaiman's one. It's about gods and stuff like that. Incredible. Do you ever just read a book and go, this is, I want to direct this as a program or a series?
All the time. I mean, I'm still a baby director in many ways, that you get trusted with the more awards that you win and the bigger the budget, the things you do, that then you're allowed to go on to the next level. And the Winkler thing won us an Emmy, which was fantastic. And
amazing.
That helps put you to the next step. But I'm very aware of my place in things, that massive blockbusters are out of my reach at the moment.
So one thing I've got to ask is, because you're still based in Manchester, and is that like, and because Manchester's an incredible place, it's incredibly creative and stuff like that, but often it doesn't appear to be the cultural capital that we all see it as. Is it viable to work as a director constantly and be able to live around Manchester, or do you have to constantly be travelling to different places? Is Manchester got enough creative output and creative stuff at the moment that allows you to thrive there as a director?
If you're a director, you're part of the travelling circus, and you need to accept that you need to make some sacrifices, and you will be constantly living out of a suitcase. whatever city you live in, you'll be traveling to other cities. Unless you do the soaps. So you could stay in London and do EastEnders, or stay in Manchester and do Coronation Street, and then you'd have a base. But for any other job in directing, you travel the world, you travel different cities. So I'd rather be in Manchester, a city that I love and I feel a creative energy from, and then travel out of that than live in London and be poor and miserable.
I feel that. But do you know what, Matt, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. And it's been really insightful because you're the first director we've ever had on the podcast, and some amazing advice and stuff that even in my field as like a presenter and creative, it's made me think, oh, well, I need to push myself more and just do more things. So I think there's a lot of people that this is going to ring true with. One question that we always ask everyone that comes on the podcast is, if you could have one word to describe Manchester, what would that word be?
Buzzing, mate.
Yeah. How is that the first time someone said that? And your accent changed completely for it. Incredible. And the other thing we ask is, if Manchester, for some miracle, just separated itself from the UK and became its own state, who would you want to lead Manchester? Who would be that character to be our noble emperor of sorts?
Look, we've had politicians who are all narcissists and professional career politicians, and none of them have worked, so it's time to give Bez a chance.
Yes. Oh, can we clip that, please, and just have that as my text tone? That's brilliant. Mate, thanks so much for popping on and giving us the time. And
my absolute pleasure, Jack. Lovely to talk to you.